Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The iconic Florida panther, the official state animal, may not be as specific to Florida as we think. In a report released in the year 2000, a team of genetic researchers found that panthers, pumas, and mountain lions in North America are actually the same subspecies. This report has since fueled arguments by developers and ranchers who are against keeping the Florida panther on the endangered species list. But even the author of the genetic study says she feels they should continue to be protected. She joins us today for our show, geneticist Dr. Melanie Culver. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you.
Also joining the show today is David Schindel with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He oversees the Florida Panther Program for the federal organization, now conducting its five-year review to determine whether the big cat will continue to be protected as an endangered animal. Thanks for being part of the show.
Thanks for having me, Julie.
And we're also joined by Amber Crooks with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, an organization that advocates for the Florida Panthers as development continues to encroach on their natural territory. Thanks for being here, Amber.
Good afternoon.
We are talking about Florida Panthers, their endangered status, and where they originally came from. What do you think of Florida's big cat? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. So the reason we're doing our show today is because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is reviewing whether the Florida panther should remain on the endangered species list. So David Schindel with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, is this a routine evaluation?
Yes, it is. A five-year review, five-year status review is mandated by the Endangered Species Act. And the reason why they're conducted is to ensure that the listing classification of an endangered or threatened species is still accurate.
It's up to date. You know, maybe they've recovered and everything's fine and they don't need those protections anymore.
Correct. And, you know, it's what new scientific information has become available and the type of information that we request. And it's an opportunity for the public to provide input, too. Is we're looking for information like on the species biology, population trends, genetic health, things like habitat conditions, how much habitat is available, how much habitat has been lost, what conservation measures have been in place or improved since the last five-year review or since the original listing, and also what threats the population still suffers from. And then the last thing that you mentioned at the very beginning, has any changes in taxonomy that have been brought to light since the last five-year review?
Does that happen very often? Different taxonomy classifications?
Sure. You know, the question of taxonomy and the science behind it and what determines a listed entity is pretty hot topic right now for many species. You know, red wolves, many bird species. So it's especially in light of the type of work Dr. Culver is doing of bringing in that molecular component and the genetic component into those determinations. It's pretty interesting.
How long does it usually take to go through this kind of a process? It's every 5 years that the process happens. How long does it take to do it?
We don't have a set deadline for the five-year reviews, and I guess that's fortunate for me. We try to get them done as quick as possible, but we want to do a thorough review. And so they could take anywhere from a year to 2 years. It kind of depends on how complex the review and the rewrite is.
Mm-hmm. So this genetic research that shows the Florida panther isn't a unique subspecies could have an impact on this decision?
It'll be one of the factors that we consider. Like as I mentioned, one of the components is any changes in taxonomy that have come to light since the original listing or since the last five-year review. And I want to make sure I make clear that the end product of this five-year review is a recommendation, and we will make a recommendation at the end of the review, and one of three recommendations will come out of it. One, the panther would go from endangered to threatened, a change in status. A second one would be no change at all, just like the last five-year review that was completed in 2009. And the third could be a delisting recommendation, and that could come for various reasons, that it achieved recovery, like you mentioned, or something like a taxonomic error.
A difference or a change in that. So, Dr. Melanie Culver, you've done genetic research on a number of animals, including the octopus. What made you look into the North American panther and puma situation?
Well, there was at that time, which was in the late, this occurred during most of the 90s, a need to review the entire species really the species at that time was listed as having 30 subspecies, and scientists felt like that needed to be reviewed. So we were able, actually, much of those samples, many of the samples were already collected, but from, say, 1991 to 95, we obtained other samples, some of them from museums. I myself went to several museums to collect samples. A postdoc in the lab, Warren Johnson, went to South America and was able to collect many samples from zoos to increase our collection of the 15 subspecies that were in South America. And I was able to review the entire species range in order to look at all of these 30 subspecies. And sometimes, like what David Schindel said about these taxonomic revisions are happening all the time. You know, with some species, like with these beautifully colored birds, sometimes every single subspecies has different forms that you can visibly see. But sometimes these forms are very cryptic. You can't visibly see the different types. So a geneticist needs to go in and look. And although pumas all look the same, you know, we felt genetics would really be able to look and see, are there really 30 different types out there, or is it, you know, something different than what was currently on the books? And we found that there were really only 6 types of pumas on the landscape throughout North and South America.
Were you surprised that there... Does that surprise you?
Yeah.
You went from a number of 30...
That was surprising.
...down to 6, and that's throughout the entire hemisphere.
Yes.
So...
And even more surprising, there was only 1 in all of North America, so 15 of them collapsed down into 1, everything north of Nicaragua. The other 5 were south of there. So there was a lot more genetic variation in South America in North America.
I was looking at your report from 2000, and I was looking at the way that the hemisphere was colored in, and I couldn't believe it. All of North America is one kind, one subspecies.
Right. And so we think that there was a historic bottleneck several thousand years ago that caused that event, and so then the Florida panther bottleneck of 100 years ago was overlaid, you know, as a second bottleneck in the history of this species.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, your study suggested the taxonomic changes to rename and identify these 6 subspecies in a manner that's more consistent with their genetic similarities. So if the Florida panther turns out to be just the same as a puma from, say, Colorado, do you believe that that should impact its protection status by the federal government?
No, because what you have now is a population. They're maybe not a subspecies, but they are an important breeding population that has a feature of being disjunct or separated from all of the rest of Western pumas. We've, as humans, managed to eliminate all of the intervening pumas for hundreds of miles in between Florida and the rest of the extant range. And so there is no gene flow. There's no natural gene flow between Florida and the rest of their range. So from a standpoint of genetic diversity, any closed population, that's what we would call Florida. They're a closed population, meaning they're closed off to gene flow. And all closed populations lose genetic diversity over time. That's a fact of genetics. And so now you have this closed population of only 200. Well, you lose genetic diversity faster the smaller you are. 200 is pretty small. It's not as small as Florida panthers were when they were 30, but it's still small. And from a recovery standpoint, we would, you know, of all the teams I've been on, we always, in order to downlist or delist, we're always looking for numbers bigger than 200 in order to consider a species recovered. So, because of the fact that 200 is going to be losing genetic variation every single generation, and so over the long term, you're going to end up with a bottleneck population, which is going to suffer inbreeding, eventual inbreeding, and possibly inbreeding depression again. So, there needs to be still some protection on a population of that size.
Mm-hmm. And Amber Crooks with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, these findings about the genetics of the Florida panther, it's not new. This is something that we've known now, at least since 2000 when this report came out. But has this information had any impact on the way that the Conservancy views the need to conserve land for these animals?
Well, Dr. Culver is certainly considered an expert in her field, and as David Schindel mentioned, it will be considered in their review, along with other information. From the Conservancy's perspective, this animal has been in Florida for millennia, and whether it's a Florida panther or a panther in Florida, we want to make sure that we protect this animal into perpetuity, and that generations from now, we're still able to have the panther here as a symbol of wild Florida. And for us, without it being listed under the Endangered Species Act, whether it be as a subspecies or through other mechanisms, that future of retaining it here and being able to keep it here forever as an integral part of our natural history is at risk. We see a lot of development coming in. The economy is definitely back, which is good if those are in the right spots, but a lot of this development is aimed into Florida panther habitat. And so we see these risks on the horizon and want to make sure that the panther has the appropriate legal protections so that we have the best chance of having it into perpetuity.
So currently we're sitting at around 200-some panthers?
I think the max was 230.
230 is what we're looking at?
Current estimate.
And when is it going to be considered recovered in your eyes from the Conservancy?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're looking to the best available science. Currently, what has been changed, so on the books, it's three populations of 240 cats each. And that may mean that these other populations are outside of Southwest Florida, but even if we get to a spot where we have some other populations in the state or beyond the state of Florida, we're going to need the habitat corridors to link those populations so that we don't get into a situation where genetically even those would be isolated from each other.
Mm-hmm. And David Schindel with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, at what number would the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service consider the Florida panther to have been recovered? Do they have kind of like the same sort of goals as far as number of cats?
Yeah, currently, you know, we have the recovery criteria that were established in the 2008 recovery plan. And that's a guidance document based on the best available science at that time to give us some, you know, those measures or those metrics of recovery. And in the 2008 plan, it was determined that we could downlist, go from endangered to threatened if we had two populations of 240 adults and subadults.
So you're looking for two populations of 240.
Under the current recovery criteria. And a complete, you know, full delisting with three populations. But, you know, there is a lot of focus on the number. And it's not just the number of animals that we consider. We consider threats. And one of the other recovery criteria components that is sometimes overlooked is the need to secure habitat and ameliorate those threats to the population. But the service has the ability to, you know, propose through rulemaking a downlisting or delisting at any time based on the best available data. Currently, we have a Florida Panther Recovery Implementation Team established, and as part of that process, Amber is a member of one of our subteams, technical subteams. We do have a subteam form that has taken a fresh look at those recovery criteria in the 2008 plan. Again, almost similar to this review, is taking into account, you know, the new available science to help us better inform what recovery looks like.
Also, and looking at what development's been doing too.
Yeah, sure, and that's part of the, you know, this 5-year review too. Also, is, you know, looking at those threats and habitat loss is a big component. But back to the population number and the metric for recovery criteria. You know, one of the benefits I think is going to come out of taking a fresh look at those criteria is one of the difficulties with the current recovery criteria is that they are based on a discrete number, and panthers and pumas in general are very difficult to to count or come up with accurate scientific rigorous estimates.
They don't just line up for a count.
Yeah, you can't go out with the spotlight and count them up. So by that, we want to have more flexibility, again, based on the best available science, of optional paths to recovery. What other metrics could be used rather than just a single number? looking at female survival, looking at, again, securing how much habitat is secured, how much habitat do they need. And so hopefully by the end of this process, we'll be able to incorporate that kind of new information to give us a better, well-informed picture of what recovery looks like for the panther.
We're talking about the Florida panther and its inclusion on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's list of endangered species. Do you have a question or a comment? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Dr. Melanie Culver, you've studied big cats in North America, and I always find it interesting how scientists and geneticists can trace an animal's arrival to certain lands and what caused them to settle where they do. Can you tell me where the Florida panther came from and how it wound up down here on the southern tip of the peninsula that we live on called Florida?
Well, the puma's closest relative is the Jaguarundi, which is a small, solid color cat that is mostly found in South America and into all the way up into Mexico. But the two together are also related to their closest relative is the cheetah, interestingly. There was a cheetah-like cat in North America, which is now extinct, but it is, it's in a genus, a fossil genus that's related to the cheetah. So what we think is that the ancestor to all three of these, was this ancestral cheetah, and that's what groups these three unlikely animals together. You know, the puma is often thought to be, because of its large size, more related to the lion. You know, it looks like a female lion.
Yeah, it's not quite as lean. Yeah, it's not as lean
right.
as a cheetah, so you would go that way, yeah.
Yeah. By looking at cats, you would never expect them to be related to the cheetah. But so that's its kind of far back evolutionary lineage. But when we then take the puma itself and look at its within that species and look at the lineage, the individual lineages, we find that the oldest lineage within the puma goes back to the highlands of Brazil, not the jungles, but kind of the more mountainous areas of Brazil. And so what we think is that from this origin between these three cats, the ancestor of the puma went down into South America after that land bridge formed, a million years ago, approximately, an ancestor to the puma crossed that land bridge into South America, and that's where the puma speciated. So it became a puma in South America, but not that long ago, only about 300,000 years ago.
That's a pretty circuitous route. It sounds very circuitous. He started in the north, went down south, then evolved into a puma, and then worked his way back up north?
Right, because there were only marsupials in South America prior to that. All carnivores really originated in North America, but a million years ago is the first that any carnivores could get into South America. But the earliest, the lineages all converged down in Brazil. So it is kind of a funny route
So can you, for America, North America back then, were there panthers all over the place? And then they just kind of ended up pocketing down here, getting stuck on the end of Florida and then out to the west? Or how did that work?
Well, we think they came into North America twice. So 300,000 years ago, or about the same age as humans. Pumas and humans are about the same age. So they immediately dispersed throughout North and South America. We see fossils about the same age after that origin. But then some event, possibly the ice age, knocked them back in North America. Then they came back a few thousand years ago. And that is probably the lineage we see in Florida now, is that recolonization that's maybe 3,000 years old.
And what other cats did we have in North America? Way back, I was reading in your paper, saber-toothed tigers. That was going on here too?
Right, right. They co-occurred with saber-toothed cats. The jaguar was around. There are fossil bones of jaguar at that time. They would have been, certainly, puma and jaguar would have been the low carnivore on the totem pole at the time when saber-tooth, and there was also a North American lion in Pleistocene times, you know, when there was also the dire wolf around. There were some pretty large carnivores at one time in North America, but that was all prior to the bottleneck that eliminated the lineages that were present in North America at one time. And then what we're looking at with Western pumas and the Florida panther is a second wave of migration into this area.
And that's what we have left. And then David Schindel with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, obviously we're way past saber-toothed tiger protections from any governmental organization. But tell me a little bit about how the endangered species list helps to protect declining populations of animals. Are they specific to each animal? For example, the Florida panther's problem is development. How can your organization protect panthers from their lands all being developed?
Yeah, that goes, you know, that is part of the mandate of the Endangered Species Act to protect the ecosystems upon which those species occur. And I would like to point out, you know, back to the discussion that the ESA protects species, subspecies, as the panther is currently classified legally, and also populations. And so there is a mechanism to provide federal protection to endangered or threatened populations. They have to meet certain criteria under what's called a distinct population segment, but we do have that mechanism.
So okay, so that's interesting because currently it's listed as a Florida panther, but even though it's now the same as what we have out in the West, it can be protected otherwise as a population?
That is one option. If it you know, once we were able to do that analysis and make that determination, it is a policy decision. But there are populations of animals, of carnivores out there now that have ESA protection as a DPS is what we refer to it.
DPS.
Distinct population segment.
Okay.
And so that's the mechanism by which the ESA can protect populations. And for, you know, a population like the panther, and again, just speculation in terms of application to this policy, it has to meet certain criteria. Well, one of those is being discreet. And a good example is being geographically isolated from other members of its taxon, other pumas, which I think, you know, it would be hard to argue that the panther is not. And then also the significance of that population relative to the other members of its taxon. And one component of that is genetics and the genetic makeup of those animals and that population. And can you determine that that population is distinct from a genetic component?
Mm-hmm.
And then also you take back to your original question, you take that population and you make the determination of kind of back to those listing factors of would it meet the criteria of endangered or threatened under the current act?
Mm-hmm. Amber Crooks with the Conservancy mm-hmm. of Southwest Florida. In addition to federal endangered protection, what other protections are there for Florida panthers? State, local, do we have any of that?
Well, in a lot of cases, and in all the cases I can think of, the state and local governments are usually deferring on decisions such as permitting and incidental take of panthers and most other federal species back to the federal government. So, you know, they may have regulations in place that help protect, and in the case of the state, help monitor scientifically that species. But all the sort of when the rubber hits the road, protections from development and road expansions and things of that nature, the ball's typically solely in the court of the U.S. federal government, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Because I remember recently the manatee was delisted as endangered. But the people that I talked with manatees, they were saying that they're not that concerned because there are still state regulations that protect them. Is there any kind of a fallback in case of something like that?
I think there are specific state laws in place that deal with manatee and speed zones, for example. But in the case of imperiled species at the state level, they actually are specifically written into their rules to defer to the federal government. So that's why keeping protected status, again, whether it be as a subspecies or as possible through this DPS mechanism, that protection under the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, is very important for this animal.
And recount for me exactly what protections that offers. It's illegal to hunt them. Mm-hmm. That's one, right? What are the other ones?
That's right. So, you know, it would protect against folks just going out and be able to either hunt or kill that panther directly. And also, when it comes to development, anytime that there is a project that would be in panther habitat or potentially affecting the panther would have to go through a process with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to determine if it would jeopardize that panther here in Florida and go through that process. And as a result of that, you would hope that they would actually preserve some of the habitat as mitigation. So that is a tool, our best tool that we have, even though it's an imperfect tool, to try to preserve panther habitat and that core habitat base that mm-hmm. we need.
Mm-hmm. And when you're living in a gated community along the coast, as many people do, you don't really think about what it's like out there in panther habitat. Who are the people that would rather not continue to protect the mm-hmm. panther?
Well, I'm sure there's a few folks out there. I'm not sure if it's you know, where the majority line falls. We certainly do get some calls from people who have had negative human interactions with panthers and bears and other wildlife. And that's why we have a program at the Conservancy to try and educate people and do some outreach about coexistence with our wildlife. People who want to keep goats or other hobby livestock in their backyards, we can sometimes work with our partners as well to help build protective enclosures. For small ranchers, we can also provide some compensation for some of their lost cattle. And I know that the federal government also has some programs to help ranchers in light of any losses to panthers. So it's all about education and providing some of those programs that some of them are already in place.
Mm-hmm. And David, what we...
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. You know, that stakeholder perspective, you know, people that may have a different opinion than the majority of folks that are advocating for panther protection. And I think it's a little bit more, you know, complex than that. In ecology, we have a concept called the landscape of fear, and it's the way the prey populations react to being the potential of being eaten. And I think we have the best way to describe, you know, some of the other sentiments is another landscape of fear, and that's not a derogatory term. Fear, it's a fear, both real and perceived, of the regulatory burden that comes along with a federally protected species. It could be come in the form of the fear or the frustration of economic loss related to that federally protected species, whether it be a cattleman that loses a calf or many calves to panthers and can't do anything about it, so to speak, because that animal is protected.
And well, there are compensation programs, though.
Yeah, they are, and that's one of our priorities is try to improve those programs. They're not perfect now, and they never will be perfect. And one of the difficult, and we appreciate the support of the Conservancy's compensation program, but a lot of it comes down to the nature of the beast and why that makes those compensation programs difficult, because a lot of times they don't find those kills just by the nature of how a panther hunts, ambushes, and covers its prey. And so there's losses that are occurring that are not documented or cannot be documented even by us. And so we're trying to find ways to mitigate that by paying on a percentage loss basis for that compensation. We're trying to make that better. And we want to have our intent is to facilitate a landscape of acceptance of the puma on the landscape in Florida. And if we continue to improve those programs, we hope we can get there. And we have to be able to tell a cattleman, you know, north of the river, that why they should want panthers and why that we should incentivize that and not allow the panther to be a disincentive, because all Floridians need what the panther needs. They need what the cattleman needs. They need what the sportsmen need. So there's a lot of shared purpose out there. It's just complicated on how we get there because social intolerance of large carnivores are the biggest hurdles to recovery, whether it be the grizzly, the wolf, and, of course, with the panther.
Yeah, humans kind of like to be the top of the food chain.
Yeah, we are.
and they like to stay there, and they like to keep their cattle. And I wanted to ask you also, can you tell me a little bit about the panther refuge in Collier County? What kind of role does that play?
Yeah, the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge is unique, and Amber can chime in. Amber is a board member on the Friends of the Florida Panther Refuge, but it's unique that it was set aside specifically for management of the panther. Probably provides some of the best habitat for panther. It sits within a larger landscape of protected lands, Fakahatchee Strand to the south, Picayune Strand, neighbors some developed areas to the west like Golden Gate Estates, and also some private land to the north that provides excellent panther habitat. So it's a important piece of the puzzle for landscape conservation for the panther.
Mm-hmm. All right, we only have a few minutes left, but we do have a call on the line. This is Rebecca calling from Cape Coral. Rebecca, what would you like to ask quickly?
I would just like to make a comment that I've been a Florida resident since 1966, and I've been working with developers for many, many years. I'm not right now, but I have for many years. I've seen vast acres of land allocated for gated communities and other types of communities, which have, you know, consistently pushed wildlife out of their natural habitat. And the panther really has not recovered that much, considering that in 1995 there were only 25 left. Right now the high number would be 230. It's somewhere between 120 and 230. But we lost 36 last year to road incidences, being hit by cars, 16 so far this year. I guess the point I'm making is that the more development there is, the more the panthers become susceptible and vulnerable to this type of situation. The other thing is that I would like to see paths, you know, crossings where the panthers could remain safe.
All right. And well, we are running out of time, and I'm sorry, I really have to cut you off. I apologize. But, you know, pathways is kind of what you were talking about earlier, but larger scale.
Yeah, thanks, Becca. I agree with your statement there. And even though we're encouraged to now have breeding females north of the Caloosahatchee and to have that increase in the population numbers by our best estimate, you know, there is a possibility we could have a tipping point if we continue to develop as we have. I mean, we looked at the numbers, and since the 80s, we've lost 100,000 acres of panther habitat, and that does continue. It's ramping up in Collier and Lee counties, and the traffic goes along with that. So I think it's very relevant to this study, this five-year assessment, all these continued threats and the possible loss in the future of additional panther habitat.
Exactly. Well, that's all we have time for today, but I do want to thank you for being part of the show. First, David Schindel, Florida Panther Coordinator with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Also, I want to thank Amber Crooks with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
And Dr. Melanie Culver, the genetic researcher unraveling the mysteries of where Florida panthers came from. Thanks so much for making a very complex subject something that I could actually understand.
Thank you, Julie.
Thanks so much for your research. Our show today was produced by Matt Smith. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. I'll be my way.